Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It was early March 1979, and I left the UCD campus mid-afternoon and went to my bedsit, a little back room over a shop in Windy Arbour. £5 a week. Now, normally, I haunted Belfield morning, noon and night. The arts block was my stately pleasure dome, my wonderful everyday and my Sunday best. My bedsit was for sleeping in and writing last-minute essays in. Being there in the afternoon was just weird. Even stranger, I fell asleep. When I woke, it was dark and, not having turned on the two-bar electric fire, very, very cold. Through the grogginess, something dawned on me and I checked the time. Oh, God. It was some time after 8 p.m. and you see, I was acting in a play in Dramsock that had started at 8. But let's rewind a bit. 2 years before, in Freshers' Week, Dramsock was one of the 10 or so college societies I'd joined once I got over the shock that the University Drama Society did not operate from an ancient ornate hall with a raised stage, my 17-year-old's notion of theatre. Dramsock HQ was a cold black box space in the basement of the arts building called, with little regard for the romance of it all, LG1. Folding doors gave access to the equally glamorous LG2. Nonetheless, production photos on display of the previous year's triumph, Shakespeare's Richard II, suggested that some kind of magic could be created. I parted with my precious 50p and joined. Some of my new college friends were convinced I was wasting my money. Dramsock was a clique, weird types, a nest of homosexuals, an appalling stereotype, which I'm very glad to say I discovered to be largely true. But the notion that this coven was unfriendly was not. The very first time I summoned up the courage to audition for a play, The Bedsitting Room, by my comic hero, Spike Milligan, I was welcomed and cast in a leading role. So here I was, starting my college life, acting in a play called The Bedsitting Room, and renting my own bedsitting room. I was free as a bird. I became, I admit, an inordinately selfish member of Dramsock. And not for me, the tiresome business of hunting down props, sticking up posters or manning the box office. I acted. I soaked up applause and laughter. Even learning lines was a tedious necessity, though I usually got there by opening night while testing the nervous systems of my more studious fellow performers. But I'd never ever missed a performance. So waking up in my bedsit when the show I was in had already started was a new and scary experience. The play, by the way, was Brand by Ibsen, directed by Dr. Joseph Long, a lecturer in the French department. Remember the Richard II production photographs that had impressed me in Freshers' Week 2 years before? He directed that. Something of a Dramsock legend, everyone wanted to be in a Joe Long production, including myself. Although, dark secret, I'd read Ibsen's Brand and thought it was spectacularly boring. When Joe offered me the minor role of the provost, I found myself experiencing a very peculiar form of envy. I really disliked the play, but was furious not to have been offered the lead role. Perhaps waking after curtain time was some unconsciously psychotic howl of rage against Ibsen, Brand, Dr. Joseph Long, and the whole wretched production. Well, I had no time to consider this fascinating psychological question because I was grabbing a coat in the dark and cantering from my bedsit out under the shadow of Dundrum Mental Hospital, along Bird Avenue, spinning left and then right at the Clonsky entrance to Belfield and sprinting down the ridiculously long avenue past dark playing fields and the looming water tower to the science block and the lake into the maw of the arts building and down, down to the basement and LG1. It was almost 9 o'clock. Through the buzzing interval crowd, I spotted three faces huddled together in tense conversation. The auditor of Dramsock, the stage manager, and Dr. Joseph Long. And now a reveal. An anticlimax, perhaps. I had reluctantly accepted a smaller role in Brand. I did not mention that the character of the provost did not appear until the second half, when, as it happens, he had quite a big scene, but that's by the way. So though I had been AWOL for the entire first half and created serious trauma for the production team, I had not actually missed my bit. Joe Long glared at my sweating, panting self and was brief. Get changed, please. In the gloom of LG2, he who had been about to read in my part clambered out of the soutane and amusing hat that was my costume, and, without a whiff of warm-up, on I went. My scene, well, I remember nothing about it. It was fine, I think. Everything had worked out fine, really. Afterwards, as I was getting out of my costume, I saw Joe coming towards me. I sighed and thought, here we go. Remember, this director was not a fellow student. He was Dr. Joseph Long of the French department. I was resigned to a terrible tirade, a monumental dressing down. Joe spoke in a cold but very even voice. You may have no respect for your own work, Jerry, but please have some respect for mine. And he walked away. That I can remember his words precisely, 42 years later, indicates the intensity of their effect. No lengthy harangue could have humbled me more than that crisp sentence. Not only did I appreciate and regret the stress I'd caused my fellow students, I realized something else for the first time. You may have no respect for your own work, he said. And my pain at this judgment told me that my involvement in Dramsoc was no passing college fling, but a serious affair. I'd never given it a second's thought, but now felt at least a flicker of understanding that this theatre thing involved giving as much respect and applause as I received. If, that is, I wanted to do it right at all. It is generally understood that going to college may change someone's life. What is not always appreciated is that the life-changing bit can happen not in moments of achievement, but of shame. However, in a story about new insights, I should emphasise that one important detail remains unchanged since that time. Trust me, Ibsen's brand really is boring.
As soon as I crest the hill at Crookanonian, the big blue of the ocean opens out. Its expanse seems to flood the land around it in a watery light. From behind the dunes, the Atlantic roar is magnified, making me crane my neck for the first view of Inishowen's giant rollers. Winter is the season when Donegal's wild beauty is at its most raw and elemental. I used to watch the nights fall with a heavy heart. I'd wait for the last swallow to leave, watch the blackberries wither, and try to cling on to autumn's bounty and summer's fading blooms. But that was before I fell in love with the winter, for its light and its darkness, and most of all, its ability to unleash the power of nature in the wild places that draws me out of my house to witness this magic for myself. On a day when the rain falls in plump drops and the wind whips around my legs, I will look out and know that it's a day for the cormorants. But it's also a day for me. These birds feel like kin. The wilder, the better for both of us, I think. The sea's energy is rising now. The soft evenings of late dips have given way to white horses bucking and churned up waters, making the horizon itself look choppy. Summer's visitors are long gone. The coffee vans have packed up. There's a quiet amid the ferocity of the elements, and I'm overcome with excitement at having a vast, open expanse of oceanfront all to myself. The sea may not be as welcoming for swimmers at this time of year, but it has a magnetism all the same. Beachcombers never know what treasure will be tossed ashore. A perfect grey cockle shell, a bright red buoy that snapped from its moorings, a heart-shaped piece of sea glass. There are late afternoons at this time of year when I look out the window at a candy-coloured evening sky and I'll want to spend the day's end at Pollen Beach in Ballyliffin. Here, I dare not get too near the ocean's edge. This is not a place to swim, but to watch the power of the sea in all her glory. You can see the breakers from miles off. There's an energy to the waves here that weaves a spell, calling you to set your churning thoughts free, to let them match the frequency of the ocean. In the distance, the hulk of Glashidi Island is taking a pummeling, currents swirling in all directions. I pull my coat tighter, head down into the wind, as I walk to Carrigabrahi Castle. I'll watch the gannets first hover, then wrap their wings tightly about themselves before dive bombing into the swell. My inky friends, the cormorants, will majestically surf the waves before facing into the wind to dry out their wings. A day can never feel ordinary once you've witnessed these things. Donegal's big winter tides seem restless, searching. They remind me of the story of how the Greek goddess Demeter is plunged into anger and grief that her daughter Persephone must spend the winter in the underworld. Only her child's return will pacify her and bring calm to the land and the waters once again. When all the colours of sunset have faded into almost darkness, the ocean becomes like a giant lantern at day's end. If I'm very lucky, as I stand facing out to sea, I might make out the shape of a pod of dolphins making their way across the bay. Winter brings its own abundance here.
I was walking down Camden Street in Dublin one warm summer's evening, close to midnight. It was 2010. I was staying close to the buildings and needed to step out a little in order to avoid tripping on something sticking out of one of the shop doorways. As I did so, I looked into the doorway and saw a man wrapped in a sleeping bag. Our eyes met. He was rolling a joint. "Hi," I said. "You like that stuff?" He smiled and gestured me an invitation to join him in smoking it. There was a piece of cardboard on the ground as a mat. He gave it a wipe and invited me to join him on it. I did, while making it clear that I would not partake in the smoking. Apart from the sleeping bag and the cardboard mat, the only other thing in the space was a half-full bottle of water. He told me his name was John, and I told him my name, Tess. I suppose on hearing my accent, he said he was from the West, and I shared that I too am from the West and still live there. He asked me my age, and when I told him, he said, "I'm 10 years younger than you. You look well for your age." I told him he didn't look bad for his age either. Both of us clearly passed our prime. I asked him why he was sleeping in a shop doorway. Was it that he didn't have a bed to go to? He assured me that he had a place to sleep and did so on wet and cold nights. But on a nice night like this, he'd prefer to sleep outdoors under the moon and stars. He suggested I lean back against the door and look up at the night sky above the city. "Just like in the West," he said. For some minutes we sat there silently absorbed in the night sky. All this time people were walking past us in the street, chatting with each other or looking down at the pavement, oblivious to the wonder of the sky above them. "Can you sing?" he suddenly asked. "No, can you?" I responded. He took a minute to answer, and then he revealed that he was checking if he could remember the words of a song for me, his guest. Then he sang a song I knew well from my childhood, Boule Vogue. He had a fine voice and a lovely natural way of singing. I joined in for the chorus and we laughed together. Then someone John knew came along and stopped to talk. John told him nicely but firmly to move along, saying that he was busy now. When he'd gone, John told me that he didn't want that man joining us because he'd only used the occasion to ask you for money, adding, "I wouldn't have you insulted like that." I asked him if he needed anything, such as something to eat, and he assured me that he had everything he needed. He asked me why I was in Dublin and for how long. I told him I was up for a funeral, the afters of which was happening in the pub up the street. Having offered me his condolences, he wondered what my relationship with the deceased was. I told him it was a friend, Mick Lally, of Glenroe fame. "Ah, Mick, Miley," he said. "I heard that on the street a few days ago." He reminisced a little about Mick, Miley, and the glory days of Glenroe. "Sure didn't we grow up with him?" he finished up. He once again offered me a drag of his joint, this time to the memory of Mick, Miley. I declined, saying that I had been drinking whiskey in the pub as my farewell to Mick. "I wouldn't mind having a whiskey in memory of Mick," he said, "although I don't drink much." So I offered to go to the pub and see if I could get a whiskey for him. He said goodbye to me and thanked me for having visited him. I got two whiskies in the pub and returned to John as promised. He was overjoyed by my return, saying that he had not expected me to come back. When I again had settled in beside him, he offered to sing me another song. This time it was "When My Father Taught Me Out in the Wide Open Fields as a Boy." He sang me "Dear Old Skibbereen" as I sipped my whiskey. It's a long song, and he had all the words. By the time he finished, I had finished my whiskey and told him I should be getting back to the pub as my husband would be wondering where I was. We wished each other all the best, and both of us said how much we had enjoyed our visit together. There's an American writer, Virginia Satir, who talks about making contact. She says you feel it. You know, when you have made contact with another human being, you feel energized, you feel alive. That's how I felt as I said goodbye to John. I hope he did too. I left him to the company of the moon and the stars.
If Oxford is the city of dreaming spires, the UCD debating scene in the 1970s was the village of perspiring dreams. I was one of those students squeezed into benches on Thursday and Friday nights at Law Society and LNH debates, lured by cheap wine at the reception beforehand and the prospect after of a bar, a party, or even a trip to the Leeson Street hotspots. And in between, there were the speakers. "Are you not entertained?" says Maximus in Gladiator. I wonder how Russell Crowe would have fared in front of the mob in Theatre L or M. There were plenty of stars who did entertain us, but the brightest light of all was the star from Abilara, Longford, the late, great Conor Gearty. I understand the antipathy to college debating. All those bow ties, all those young men and women enraptured by the sound of their own voices. But perhaps those brash displays of confidence conceal a deeper unease. Sally Rooney, herself a prize-winning speaker, once suggested that low self-esteem and a predilection for hero worship was the perfect cocktail for a novice debater. Although, as trusting young students, we channeled our inner Holden Caulfield in our eagerness to call out all things phony, college debating requires participants to fervently endorse propositions in which they have no faith whatsoever. As the comedian George Burns noted, and countless student debaters have repeated, the secret of success is sincerity. If you can fake that, you've got it made. So what made Conor Gearty such a brilliant speaker? He had wit and guile and a boyish charm, so boyish that we struggled to be let into a nightclub after one debate. Sally Rooney says being a debater means you have to learn how to lose. But Conor won every competition he entered. When he and Donal O'Donnell, another accomplished, clever speaker, won the Observer Mace Trophy twice in a row, the organisers considered changing the rules to stop them entering again. The concept of a debating team is complicated, with some pairings which no matchmaker or dating app could produce. What if one partner is significantly weaker than the other, as I was when chosen to speak with Conor in the Irish Times debating competition? Notwithstanding misgivings he tactfully concealed, Conor, won the competition and remained friends. Some college friendships don't survive the lecture halls, the coffee shops, the playing fields and bars. Perhaps the intensity of that shared experience is of its time, an exotic firework briefly lighting up the sky before burning out. Conor became a gifted and much-loved lecturer in Cambridge and King's College London before becoming Professor of Human Rights at LSE. We kept in touch and met from time to time. There is a picture of us tipsy on an English summer lawn. And when we did, Conor was brimming with the same energy and humour, whether dissecting some curious pronouncement by the UK Supreme Court or analysing the decline of the Irish soccer team. At a reunion of Irish Times debating winners, the rest of us were greyer, bolder, wider, or just older. But Conor looked exactly the same, still sporting his idiosyncratic mop-top hairstyle, still making us laugh. His recent sudden death came as a shock. Like many others, I'll miss his warmth, his vigour, his distinctive chuckle, and his ability to ridicule pomposity, all delivered with his trademark panache that recalled those sweaty, raucous nights in UCD. And maybe those debating nights weren't wasted after all. After his death, a friend reminded me that Conor originally had doubts about what he called our articulate promiscuity, regarding it as evidence of a vacuous core at the heart of our performances. But over time, he changed his mind, particularly in these days where, as he put it, the art of persuasion matters less than the display of an untouchable point of view. Debating, he said, breaks down that certainty. It forces you to enter the mind of the holder of an opposing view and even advocate for it. Try it for yourself. Push yourself into places where the feeling is different, where the experiences driving ideas are not your own. You'd be surprised what you find. As so often, Conor was right. Whether listening to him speak, reading something he'd written, or simply chatting over dinner, in his company I found the world a little easier to understand, because Conor made it so. In a time depressingly short of heroes, Conor Gearty was one of mine.
Sei venuta in sogno a me un di lontano, mai detto questo sarà il tuo futuro.
It was not a victory, there was no triumph. Only an exhausted sigh of relief as the world mourned its dead, and a generation of soldiers became ghosts, destined to live forever as young men suspended in time, inhabiting the memories of the parents and wives and lovers who had waited. When peace was declared at 11 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, there was little to celebrate. The mood was of lamentation. Anger would follow. Ordinary people blamed their leaders. Families grieved for sons and brothers, husbands and fathers. The maimed, shell-shocked veterans who did return were often shunned as damaged reminders of horrors best forgotten. Instead of a predicted brief skirmish, the conflict had dragged on for 4 years and 3 months, redrawing the maps of Europe, causing empires to collapse. An estimated 17 million died. In the global upheaval, as many as 70 million military personnel were mobilised. It was the first time a war had not been confined to the battlefield. Total war had emerged. National economies were directed at producing munitions. Factories were converted to the manufacture of weapons. Supplying armies became an industry. Vehicles were requisitioned, as were horses, some 8 million of which perished. Instead of the dramatically choreographed cavalry charges of the past, trench warfare extended over vast areas of territory, creating filthy, rat-infested squalor. Torrential rain throughout July 1917 at Passchendaele resulted in more men dying through suffocating in the mud than from wounds. Adding to the disastrous physical conditions were vicious technological advancements. Poison gas, barbed wire, tanks, and aerial bombardment. Late in his novel, The Radetzky March, Joseph Roth, veteran of the Eastern Front, an inspired chronicler of his beloved Austro-Hungarian Empire, describes the reaction when news of the assassination of Emperor Franz Joseph's unpopular nephew finally reaches a military outpost at the most easterly edge of the then empire, which had extended to the Russian border. The cavalry officers, enjoying splendid uniforms, magnificent horses, and willing women, drink, swagger, and exchange banter. War is but an abstract concept. They dismiss Archduke Franz Ferdinand's death as a rumour, oblivious that their world will die with him. Eerily, it had all been foreseen as early as 1888, when the shrewdest of German chancellors, Otto von Bismarck, had announced, "One day, the great European war will come out of some damned foolish thing in the Balkans." He judged correctly. A nervous young Bosnian Serb, Gavrilo Princip, a member of the secret nationalist organisation Unification or Death, the Black Hand, was one of seven assassins dispatched to Sarajevo. The royal visit was to facilitate Ferdinand's proposals, granting concessions to South Slavs, which would block hopes of securing an independent Serbian state. One of Princip's co-assassins on June 28, 1914, had already thrown a bomb which had exploded under another car, causing the royal party to be driven on to a reception, shocked if unharmed. After the presentation, en route to visit those injured in the car blast, the Archduke's driver took a wrong turning which brought the royal motorcade, ironically, into Franz Joseph Street, where Princip had just bought a sandwich. He fired two shots, one killing Archduchess Sophie outright. The Archduke died within minutes. Many millions of deaths would follow. Although the Serbs in Belgrade had accepted all but one of the Austro-Hungarian demands, outlined in an outrageous 10-point ultimatum, the sole refusal, that of ending anti-Austrian propaganda, was enough. Austria declared war on Serbia. From July 1914, the nations of Europe joined in. Germany would support Austria-Hungary. When the Kaiser asked his cousin the Tsar for his support against Serbia, he was refused. The Russian Empire would assist its fellow Slavs. Germany declared war on Russia. The next day saw Germany and France declare war on each other. Britain, though in alliance with France and Russia, hesitated. But then Germany invaded Belgium. History's many ironies confirm that 200,000 Irishmen enlisted in the British Army. Back home in Ireland, assorted dreamers, idealists and poets staged an insurrection. On April 6, 1917, the United States entered the war. The old order was changing. Empires did fall. The Russian, the German, the Austro-Hungarian, and finally the Ottoman, the sick man of Europe. Writers and artists went to serve. Many were to die, such as Alain Fournier, slain in the first weeks. Poets Wilfred Owen and Edward Thomas. Francis Ledwidge was killed while assisting stretcher bearers. Also lost was German expressionist painter Franz Marc. Others returned, such as writers Robert Graves and Siegfried Sassoon, while J.R.R. Tolkien saw atrocities on the Somme, which influenced the nightmarish battle sequences in The Lord of the Rings. Also posted to the Somme was German artist Otto Dix, who, in common with Sassoon, was initially excited by the notion of going to war. Sassoon changed his mind about combat being a jolly outing and made loud his protests. Dix created his chilling De Craig war sequence of 52 stark etchings, and at the end of his life, in 1969, admitted the war had truly haunted him. Playwright Bertolt Brecht survived, as did the surrealist Jean Cocteau. Artist Georges Braque suffered serious head wounds and never forgot his ordeal. Ralph Vaughan Williams volunteered to fight in France. His frail fellow composer Gustav Holst drove an ambulance. It is said that the last sounds Claude Debussy heard while dying in Paris in March 1918 were German guns bombarding the city. One German soldier, Erich Maria Remarque, articulated it. All Quiet in the Western Front was published in an English translation within 2 months of its German publication. It sold 275,000 copies in less than 6 weeks. Celebrated in the UK, it was denounced in Germany as defeatist. In it, the young narrator, Paul Baumer, reports, "We have become wild beasts. We do not fight. We defend ourselves against annihilation. It is not against men that we fling our bombs. Death is hunting us down." An uneasy peace was declared. It was to prove merely an interlude. Another world war was already gathering a sinister momentum.
Sister Stan. For me, Sister Stan means sanctuary, the wild sanctuary of people laughing. The last time I saw Stan was in St. James's. I'd come to visit one of me favourite carrymen, and sure, Stan was already there, bedside, perched on a chair and sharing gossip from the kingdom. That proud Kerry woman and Kerry man took one look at this dub and Stan kicked off with, "Ayera, do you think the Dubs will ever win as many All-Irelands as the Kingdom?" Of course, this true blue had to counter with, "Now Stan, given that half of Dublin County's Banish Tours are pure bog trotters like you, I'd say any day now, we'll grab that prize too." The Kerry man was quite ill, stuck in a hospital ward, waiting for word on a place to call home. And yet there he was, beaming at the banter. He leapt into this verbal fracas with, "Hey Stan, how do you spot a Jackeen from Finglas? She's the one who goes into the revolving door after you and yet somehow manages to come out before you." We laughed and we laughed. Stan, dear Kerry woman, pure champion, so many Dubliners love you to bits. You knew housing was a human right and understood the human need for laughter. For me, Sister Stan means sanctuary, the wild sanctuary of people laughing in the kingdom of their very own homes. When Stan meets St. Peter, odds on, he too will say, "Yup, the kingdom."
on this morning's programme, a mix of new and recent archive scripts, we heard Never Too Late by Jerry Stembridge, Winter in a Shoan by Cathy Donaghy, A Night Visit by Tess Hughes, and then The Art of Persuasion, Remembering Conor Gearty by John O'Donnell, and that was followed by Remembrance by the late Eileen Battersby, and then Sister Stan by Rachel Hegarty, a poem for the late Sister Stanislaus Kennedy, founder of Focus Ireland. And the music today, I Won't Let You Down by PhD, Indigo Sky by Sharon Shannon and the RTE Concert Orchestra, Boulevogue by Noel Hill on concertina, Il Gladiatore, composed by Hans Zimmer and sung by Pavarotti, and The Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams, performed by Nicola Benedetti. And just a quick reminder that we have a new Sunday Miscellany anthology. It's called Sunday Miscellany, a selection 2023 to 2025, published by New Ireland Books. It's in the shops and it's up for an Unpost Irish Book Award. The nomination is in the category thejournal.ie Best Irish Published Book. And you can find out more and vote at irishbookawards.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator today was Mary Elizabeth Bruton. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.